Hello and welcome everyone to AuthorsAudio.com, where we interview international authors from all around the world. I'm your host, Jake D. Steele. Today we feature a very interesting author with a very special message. Dr. Jerome Corsi's new publication is The Late Great USA, and it's all about the coming North American political and economic union. How would you like the idea of no national borders and a standard Amero currency in Canada, the USA, and Mexico? Dr. Corsi is a staff reporter for WorldNet Daily. He received his PhD from Harvard University in political science in 1972 and has written many books and articles. His last book was Minutemen, The Battle to Secure America's Borders with Minutemen founder Jim Gilchrist. He's also published Black Gold Stranglehold, The Myth of Scarcity and the Politics of Oil, which he co-authored with WorldNet columnist Craig R. Smith. Also, Showdown with Nuclear Iran and Atomic Iran. It's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Jerome Corsi to Authors Audio.
A great pleasure and honor to be with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Jerry. It's a great pleasure to have you on our show to talk about your book, The Late Great USA. This book has had a serious look at the ongoing discussions to create a North American Union, an amalgamation of Canada, the USA, and Mexico into one large economic and political entity. Now, I understand it all came out of a little agreement, a little innocuous agreement called the Security and Prosperity Partnership. Can you tell our listeners a little of how you came to uncover this amazing story, Jerry?
Well, I started when I was doing my previous book, Minutemen, The Battle to Secure America's Borders, which I co-authored with Jim Gilchrist. Jim is the founder of the Minutemen Project. And we spent a good deal of time on the border, and the obvious question was, we're now 6 years into a war on terror, and yet our borders with Mexico and Canada are wide open, and it makes no sense. And I always start out in, you know, in politics, things happen for a reason. I didn't, and we researched, and I found out I could prove the terrorists had come across that border. The case of Muhammad Khorrani, he bribed Mexican officials in Beirut. Coyotes brought him across the border with Mexico. He set up shop in Dearborn, Michigan, and was sending money back to Hezbollah terrorists in Lebanon, and he's in federal prison right now. So there's proof positive the terrorists had come across the border. And I didn't assume that, you know, the border is wide open because President Bush, you know, forgot he was busy that day. And it needed an explanation. And as I hunted around, I realized that on March 23rd, 2005, at a summit meeting in Waco, Texas, the three leaders had met at Baylor University, President Bush, with then the president of Mexico, Vicente Fox, and Canada's prime minister, who was then Paul Martin. At the end of this meeting, they came out in front of the press and they announced that we were in the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America. There was no law, no treaty, just evidently the, you know, a handshake and a wink and a nod and a press release. And so I looked, you know, I started researching it, and the spp.gov, sampeterpaul.gov, website came up. SPP.gov is a government website. It's maintained in the Department of Commerce, and it's the website of the Security and Prosperity Partnership. And this website now documents that we have some 20 working groups, and working groups is a term of trade for the European Union, of our bureaucrats meeting with Mexico's bureaucrats and Canada's bureaucrats in a formal structure, integrating and harmonizing our laws. So page 81 of the book, I got and published from a Freedom of Information Act request an organizational chart of these working groups, all the little boxes, the North American Transportation Working Group, the North American Energy Working Group, the North American whatever working group. There's 20 of them. They report up to three cabinet secretaries in each of the governments, Secretary of State Rice in the middle and Secretary of Commerce Gutierrez and Chertoff and Homeland Security. Then the little boxes report up to the National Security Council and the Homeland Security Council in the White House, and further on up to the President. Now, if I can get the organizational chart of these working groups from the government in a Freedom of Information Act request, but that chart is published nowhere by the government, not even on the SPP website. The SPP.gov website, it says, oh, this is just a dialogue between three neighbor nations so that we can be more competitive in a global economy.
Well, that's how it started out, right, Jerry? And then it seemed to change direction very quickly.
Right. And packaged under security and prosperity, you know, two words that George Orwell couldn't have picked better, you know, from writing,
right.
You know, from writing
1984, right.
or Aldous Huxley, Brave New World. You know, these are words that should reassure people. This is just to make you more secure and more prosperous. And I guess if we go to SPP.gov and click it right, it'll play us Bobby McFerrin music, you know, don't worry, be happy. This is all for your good. Except that,
yes.
You know, if I can get the organizational chart, and then the government on SPP.gov puts up a little myths versus facts section, they say this is just a dialogue. Well, an organizational chart of bureaucrats from three nations, formally structured, reporting to cabinet levels, that's already a multinational shadow government. It's not just a dialogue. You don't have to structure
right.
a dialogue. You know, if I want a dialogue,
exactly.
I'll pick up the telephone and say hello. I'll go visit my neighbor. That's a dialogue. This is a formally structured, organizational, bureaucratic, trinational government in hiding.
It that seems to be what it is. Yes, it's a shadow government. And I was going to ask you, who or what is driving this idea, Jerry? Who benefits from this concept? I never believed strongly in NAFTA, but this is NAFTA plus.
Well, the winners are the multinational corporations. The multinational corporations have been pushing this agenda for decades. They want to have a North American common market area where they can operate as their base, and then within that have no regulations. I mean, environmental regulations, workplace safety regulations, product control or quality regulations, these are all speed bumps for multinational corporations. You know, they're expensive. And especially when three countries have different regulations for different reasons, that's more expensive. And then three currencies is a nuisance because you've got then currency risk. So if you can go to one currency and no regulations, especially no regulations that are different, within a
yes.
North American market, then you can plug that into a world market. And the real prize here, what the multinational corporations are really after, is it's another wave, another attempt, probably about the third one I can find in modern history, the last 300 years, a most recent attempt to get slave labor. Because
yes.
the unbridled capitalism loves slave labor. If there's slaves in China, multinational corporations want them. If there's slaves that can be brought in as an underclass from Mexico to undercut U.S. workers, and the multinational corporations are allowed to do it, they're saying, why not?
Well, I was just going to say to you that this so-called union is really going to bring down most middle-class incomes in Canada and the United States. This would be the last peg in destroying the middle class as we know it, wouldn't it?
Yes, it will. I mean, Alan Blinder, professor of economics at Princeton, who advised Clinton to sign NAFTA, now he admits that his own plans here, the so-called free trade, and these agreements, by the way, are not free trade. That's another lie I expose in the book. Free trade is fair trade.
Right.
Al Blinder says we're going to lose 40 million jobs in the next two decades, outsourced largely to China and India. That's twice as many manufacturing jobs as we currently have.
40 million jobs. Well, this is a real shock, going to be a real shock to North Americans in general who have looked at maybe, 4 to 6% unemployment as being quasi-normal. With this, aren't we going to see a lot more unemployment as
yes,
people vie for the few jobs that are left?
And a lot more people dropping out of the labor force altogether because they just give up. I mean, the jobs we're creating already are service jobs. Well, you know, flipping hamburgers at the hamburger joint is a service job. It's not going to pay you what manufacturing a car in Detroit would have paid you, But, you know, Chrysler is shutting down in Detroit and saying they're going to go over to China and make cars with Chery, a Chinese company, and put them on boats and bring them back into the United States. Because, see, that's the other part of this. As, you know, Ross Perot was right, NAFTA and now this move towards the Security and Prosperity Partnership is a great sucking sound as the jobs leave North America. But right behind the sucking sound, there's a big whooshing sound, and that's the millions of containers that China plans to send back in here with the defective slave-made goods. Now, for a, you know, multinational corporations aren't going to win if they can just get the cost of labor to zero. It was still expensive to transport the goods, they lose. So now they've got to get the transport, the cost of transporting those goods as close to zero as possible. And this is where the NAFTA superhighways come into place. These ports down south of Texas, if you look at the map, Mexico has ports on the Pacific, Manzanilla and Lazaro Cardenas. They're
south of
Texas. They're on the Pacific. They're southeast of the Baja. Okay, and Texas, you know, swings across, so it's actually under, Mexico swings across, so it's actually under Texas. And by the Chinese, by the way, operate these ports. Hutchison Ports Holding, they're a subsidiary of Hutchison Whampoa, a company with close ties to the Chinese military. That ought to make everybody feel comfortable.
Yes.
And China is putting billions into deepening these ports, because now a new class of container ships, mega container ships, that won't even fit through the Panama Canal, they're called post-Panamax. These ships will hold 12,500 containers. Now, to give you the idea of dimension, it's like moving 10 square blocks of New York skyscrapers across the Pacific Ocean. And you could do it with a crew of 13.
Wow.
And, you know, it's four times as big as any container ship most people have ever seen. The average container ship, which is already huge, is about 4,500 containers. This is 12,500. If they can be unloaded in a Mexican port, where they don't have to be unloaded in Long Beach or Los Angeles, where longshoremen are more expensive because they're union workers, if the containers, which now intermodal is the big transportation buzzword, intermodal means the container with China with the cheap slave goods is put on a boat and does not have to be unpacked or repacked. It just, the container can be lifted and put onto a truck or a train, and it can be brought north or wherever to its ultimate destinations or to intermediate destinations that serve as regional warehousing hubs. So that's what intermodal means, and all this is designed to be intermodal, read cheap, unloaded at a Mexican dock, put onto a Mexican truck and carried by a Mexican train. And, you know, now we're reconfiguring these NAFTA superhighways, the Trans-Texas Corridor, 4 football field wide, new superhighway, trucks, trains, pipelines, Tower Electric that Texas is planning, 1,200 feet, 4 football fields wide, to cut in a new path parallel to Interstate 35 from Laredo up past Austin, up past San Antonio, up past Dallas, to the border with Oklahoma. Well, it's going to be a container moving system, and you've now got cities like Kansas City, San Antonio, and even Denver saying they're inland ports. Where's the water? You know, in Kansas City, it's not the river. It's not the Kansas River. In Denver, it's not the Platte River. I've lived there, and in San Antonio, it's not the Riverwalk. They're ports, inland ports, because the water's down in Lazaro Cardenas and Manzanilla.
Well, this is a likening. You could liken this to an invasion of China and other countries, literally just leaking into our system and destroying any value that our system currently has.
That's right. And what I'm arguing is that the loss of sovereignty will happen exactly like it happened in Europe. That it's a stealth process. If you go back, we now have the writings of people like Jean Monnet, who's one of the chief architects of the European Union. He wrote his memoirs just before he died. He's a Frenchman. And it was clear he was going after one world government. It was clear he wanted Germany to lose its sovereignty because he felt like Germany caused two world wars, and he was French. And Monet felt like, you know, especially the Second World War, France would have lost if it had not been for the United States. He didn't want Germany to rise again. So they started 50 years ago, 1957, with the Treaty of Rome and a coal and steel agreement, because Monet knew two things. He thought if Europe controlled the coal and steel, Germany couldn't build another army. And starting down the path of economic agreements, they would have to have judicial processes in place to settle disputes that would necessitate regional laws. It would necessitate regional government. So now we have the, you know, European common market going to the European Union in 1999, Treaty of Maastricht. And now by 2002, we have the euro. And our elite are saying we'll go down the same step-by-step path from NAFTA to the Security and Prosperity Partnership. Our elite are talking already about a North American community by 2010. And we'll go to a North American Union, and our currency has been named. It will be the Amero, the A-M-E-R-O, as a counterpart to the euro, replacing the dollar. And if the elite can name the currency that they intend to put in place, I think we better take the plan seriously.
Well, I'm wondering, we're really talking about just a lowering of values and really the value of your home, value of your job, all that. So will things eventually that will get cheaper so that it will be able to afford all these things they're bringing in?
Well, it'll be sold on the basis. Look at all the cheap TVs you can get in Walmart. Look at all the cheap electronics. Yes. It'll be sold to people that way. And people will be lucky to have a job to be able to buy them. But the point is that that's a lie, too. I mean, even the studies going done back to the Bracero program. Remember, in the Eisenhower administration, we used to bring up migrant workers to pick the fields, largely in Southern California.
Exactly.
And the agricultural owners said they couldn't do it without these migrants. Well, we ended the Bracero program, and the cost of food went marginally up. The companies did not go out of business. They automated. And it was a marginal increase in the cost of their production. The labor is, you know, the idea that just because they had to pay a little bit more for the labor, even Cesar Chavez, who organized the Hispanic farm workers in the 60s, he opposed the migrant workers too, because he knew that the impact and the whole reason to have them was that slaves would lower the cost of labor. And labor is one of the major costs in production. So if you can lower the cost of labor, it increases the margins for the people who own the company and the multinational executives. And that's the whole scheme here. I mean, I guess we're just going to forget that at the end of the Civil War, we decided that it was immoral to use African-American slaves in Southern agricultural businesses. It's okay now if we wink-wink go get Chinese slaves or bring in a Mexican underclass and employ them at below-market wages. I mean, that's okay. That's all wink-wink.
Yeah. This is not only unethical, but, of course, it's just ruining all the values that our societies have, you know, gleaned over the years, over hard-fought wars and other things to lift us up out of that mire. And this is just going to throw us right back into it.
Well, and that's the problem, is that, say, you know, I agree with you that the, you know, whenever you go to Arlington Cemetery, I reflect that the men and women who were buried there did not fight and die for North American Union.
No.
And these multinational corporations and the intellectual elite are like George Soros. They're beyond nation states. They write things like, nation states belong to a time when kings had castles.
Right.
And Ben Steele, one of the top economists of the Council on Foreign Relations, two issues ago in the Council on Foreign Relations Foreign Affairs magazine, published an article on the end of national monetary currencies. It said, you know, national monetary currencies were, again, kings had castles. We need to go to a regional currencies on the way to a world currency.
Right.
And with the Amero will come a North American central bank. That's the that's the plan. That's what the economists who favor this, you know, this continental monetary unit are arguing for.
Well, this is going to be a how we put it, like an enlarged Federal Reserve concept, I would imagine.
It'll stand above the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve will probably be gone if we have an Amero.
It'll be the Amero Reserve.
If it exists, it'll be the North American Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
North American Monetary Reserve, North American whatever reserve. The corporations, unbridled capitalism, and we do not have unbridled capitalism, tends towards slaves. You can remember what I call the second wave, all the photographs from Jacob Riis and the photographers at the turn of the century in the 1900s that show the pictures of the women with, you know, seamstress factories crowded in there making no money, the children working shoeless in factories, again making no money, you know, 18-hour days, the children in the mines. If we allow the labor unions and, you know, people, whatever they think about labor unions today, we probably in the 20s would have gone through a communist revolution because labor was being so terribly exploited had it not been for the labor unions demanding that the capitalists share with the workers the value of what was being produced, that they fairly value the value of their labor. The labor be constituted as an element of capital itself and be compensated.
Yes.
We're losing that principle when we're allowing our multinational corporations to go to China, and globalism becomes a code word. You know, we've got to be more competitiveness in a global economy. Translate means, I don't want to pay you so much, and I can get somebody else to do it cheaper. So we all ought to become like Walmart. You know, why don't you work here for nothing or for so little you can't even afford the health insurance I offer?
Well, the corporate... Yes, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Jerry.
I was going to say, when I was a kid, labor was compensated, and people had health insurance. They had it at their place of employment. Today, we've step-by-step allowed these companies saying, well, we've got to be more competitive, the global economy. We're going to cut out this benefit, cut out that benefit. We're going to pay you less. I mean, this is a conscious scheme. We're into a third wave of unbridled capitalism on a world basis to cut the cost of labor.
Yes. I was just talking to a friend the other day, and we just had I'm from Toronto, Canada. We have just had a provincial election yesterday, where the Liberals, as it's, Americans will think it's a slightly different term than American liberalism, but the Liberals got in handily, and they'll be in for another 4 years. But it got me thinking, Jerry, about how antiquated the ballot system is in the age of the 21st century. We're still being asked to mark one X down for a political party that will make that we give the opportunity to make a million decisions for us. Most of them we probably haven't even thought of or don't want. And I was thinking just how strange that is, that what we really should have in the 21st century is a ballot that has real questions on it that you could tick off or not, that would give the ballot some sort of increased value for your vote. And yet this is the other way.
Yeah. The point I'd want to make is that in the United States, when you take a look at the Democrats and Republican Party, you can't tell the difference.
Right. You can't.
On most issues. And the large reason for that is because the multinational corporations are paying the politicians of both parties. You know, you've got George H.W. Bush talking about one world government, giving speeches before joint sessions of Congress in which he, you know, spins off eloquently about how wonderful it's going to be in this new one world government. They got Bill Clinton giving the same speeches and getting NAFTA signed. Of course, Bill Clinton never saw a campaign contribution from China, legal or illegal, that he didn't like. Took them all. And now George W. Bush, who is just openly, I think, pursuing a North American Union integration strategy. And remarkably, this week on CNN, when Vincente Fox is on his great book tour, you know, he's published this book.
Right.
And Vincente Fox was asked a question from an email viewer, and Fox kind of spilled the beans. He let the cat out of the bag, to use another, you know, metaphor. I mean, the question was, Mr. Fox, I'd like to know how you feel about the possibility of having a Latin America united with one currency. And Fox says, long term, very long term, what we propose together, President Bush and myself, is ALCA, A-L-C-A, was a trade union for all the Americas. ALCA is a Spanish acronym for the Free Trade Act of the Americas.
Right.
So what Fox is saying there is that he and President Bush did have a plan. They were going to extend NAFTA, not just through CAFTA, Central America, but all the way down to the tip of South America in this Free Trade Act of the Americas. And Fox then says everything was running fluently until Hugo Chavez came along. He decided to isolate himself. He decided to combat the idea and destroy the idea. Well, Fox is accurate. There was a meeting in Argentina, I think it was early in 2004. President Bush was advancing the idea of the Free Trade Act of the Americas, and Hugo Chavez acted up and scuttled the whole deal. And so Bush shelved it for the time.
Jerry, I think recently I saw on the Internet most of the countries of South America just in the last few days got together to articulate the beginnings of a South American central bank or bank. This just happened.
They're trying to revive the idea from South America, but you're still going to have Chavez oppose it if the United States dominates it. The Bush-Fox plan got scuttled, but listen to what Fox says next. King says it's going to be like the euro dollar then. And Fox says, well, that would be long term. But I think the process is to go, first step is a trading agreement, and then further on a new vision like we were trying to do with NAFTA. So there you've got Fox. So, I mean, just up in Montebello on August 20th and 21st, President Bush is asked at the end of this SPP summit meeting, the third summit meeting, Fox News reporter asked Bush, I was sitting in the room, I had press credentials from WorldNet Daily, and three leaders were asked by the Fox News reporter if the Security and Prosperity Partnership in North America was going to end up being a North American Union or NAFTA superhighways. And Bush said, oh, that was all conspiracy theory. Now, he didn't answer the question. He didn't say structurally, here's the reasons that the SPP and a North American Union are distinguished, and here's why one cannot go to the other. He ridiculed, and ridicule, as we've known since the ancient Greeks, is the last refuge of a scoundrel in a debate. Can't answer the question with logic, facts, or analysis. They just call you name. And now we've got Vincente Fox promoting his book on the Larry King Show, and Vincente Fox lets the cat out of the bag. He says, yeah, Bush and I had a plan. It was to extend these free trade agreements. We have a new vision with NAFTA. I guess that's the North American community. And, by the way, they're going to include evolving into regional currencies. So who's the conspirators now? I mean, this is a complete admission by Fox that the plan we've been asking questions about, you know, the collapse of the dollar, which is underway and I'm arguing is being engineered, is happening full speed ahead. And as the dollar collapses, I'm sure a regional currency will be rolled out. We'll be told, well, in order to be competitive globally, we have to have a common North American market where we can freely go after the resources in Canada. You know, NAFTA defines Canadian freshwater, timber, minerals, and oil as goods. And those goods have to be shared. Those goods have to be shared in the NAFTA marketplace without restraint. So if Canada thinks those are natural resources that can be protected, forget it. That was given away in NAFTA.
Unbelievable. Yes, I know that.
And this highway that we're building, the superhighway down in Texas, with the pipelines down the middle of it, well, where are they going to get the oil, natural gas, and water to put in those pipelines? My first thought would be to look to Canada. And Mexico might not have, you know, Mexico's already shipping us their underclass, so we'll take the whole underclass. And then we have the slave labor, and that'll be factored into the continental equation of value.
It's just a change that most people can't even imagine that this could possibly happen in their lifetime. But you mentioned in your book that some of this stuff is already happening, I know, and it could realize itself as soon as, say, 2010.
Well, look, the Bush administration says we've got 12 million illegal aliens in the United States. Okay, those are numbers that come out of the Pew Institute that the Bush administration decided to adopt. Pew Institute also says about 60% of those have come in while George W. Bush has been president. We have one, under those numbers alone, I think the numbers are probably two or three times that great, but under the 12 million figure, that means we've got one-tenth of Mexico's population living here in the United States. They're living here as Mexican nationals. They've now got 47 consular offices here to protect the rights of the Mexican nationals living in the United States as Mexican citizens. By 2010, that's going to be 20% of Mexico's population. As I pointed out, there's no structural impediment in place that would stop that from going to half or more of Mexico's population. There's no fence, and we're not enforcing our immigration laws. Now, we've already become a dual country, and people say, well, you know, these changes couldn't happen without a vote. Well, I didn't vote to get 12 million illegal aliens in the country. Congress voted to have a Secure Fence Act. President Bush signed it in October 2006. Next month, the elections were held, and so I guess after the public relations impact of signing this bill was over, you know, Duncan Hunter, the Republican congressman from California running for president, who was instrumental in getting the fence built in San Diego, he wrote a letter to the president and said, we've only built 18 miles of this fence, and we're behind schedule, the congressionally mandated schedule. And then when it does come to a vote, I mean, you know, Michael Medved, this movie critic who's a radio talk show host, he ridicules all the time this idea of North American integration. Medved said, it's ridiculous. We couldn't have a North American Union without changing the Constitution. We'd have to vote. Well, my point is, the way it was done in Europe is first the fait accomplis were created. Then the votes were allowed to happen. So first we get 20% of Mexico's population in here. Then George Bush comes to Congress and says, I can't do anything about this problem that I created. What do you want me to do, round up 12 million people? Well, nobody's asking for that. We were saying build a fence and enforce our employment laws and these people will leave. So George Bush says the only vote you can take is to figure out one way or another to give them a legitimate right to stay. And that was where this Comprehensive Immigration Reform Act, this Kennedy-McCain-Shamnesty compromise, George Bush tried to jam down the throats of Congress, once returning from Albania, saying in Albania, I'll see you at the signing ceremony. The American people said no. They called their congressman and blocked it. But we still have not solved the problem. Blocking the Shamnesty bill did not settle anything.
No, it didn't. As a matter of fact, the terminology used for, I just heard it on the news the other day, it just made me laugh. The people that were caught, there were Mexican people, I guess, caught in Texas somewhere the other day, and it was a Texas police force that was checking all the people that it had stopped for various violations, checking to see if they were legal or illegally in the country. There was a big to-do about that, and someone said, well, these people are just undocumented workers. They're not illegal immigrants. They're undocumented workers.
Oh, yes. I did a big analysis of that, of, you know, the word usage and the semantics of this debate in the book I wrote with Jim Gilchrist, Minutemen.
Right. Okay.
The terms are being used to pretty it up. These people are illegal aliens, but yet, you know, La Raza and the group supporting them does not want even the word alien used.
No, they don't.
They want to say no person is illegal. Well, I agree no person's illegal, but some people commit crimes, and a crime is illegally entering the United States without permission and staying.
Jerry, why do you think that the major media outlets, for the most part, are giving a complete blind eye to this incredible story?
Well, again, it's money. I mean, the multinational corporations, you know, probably five, six multinational corporations control 75 to 85% of the media. I had an argument. I was with one of the Wall Street Journal editorial writers on a panel a few months ago, and he was bragging, going on about globalism and how great it is. And I stood up and said, you know, Stephen Moore's only reason he loves globalism is he doesn't think that Murdoch, when he acquires the Wall Street Journal, can find an Indian from India who will do Mr. Moore's column for half the pay. And I said, I assure you, Mr. Moore, they teach economics in India.
They do, yes. They definitely do. And we haven't talked about the the NAFTA superhighway that you mentioned in your book also. And Mexican trucks are already driving straight into the States, are they not, with goods?
Yes, they are. Department of Transportation went ahead and jammed its Mexican truck experiment through. There's two amendments that Congress passed, the House and the Senate, to the transportation funding bill that would take the money away from the Department of Transportation to do the Mexican truck program. Yet that bill has not been brought to, it's not out of conference, it didn't go to the President's desk, and President Bush has said he would veto it. So instead of respecting the will of Congress and putting a halt to the Mexican truck program until we see what happens to this legislation, Department of Transportation thumbed their nose and said, it's not a law yet, we'll just continue letting the Mexican trucks cross the border. So every day they're rolling. And then the next thing is said, well, there's no plan, you know. Mary Peters, I thought Virgil Goode was good about this. I interviewed him. He's a Republican congressman from Virginia. He has a resolution, House Concurrent Resolution 40, which says no North American Union, no NAFTA superhighway. I interviewed Virgil Goode, and he said, you know, they're just gaming semantics in the White House. He said, I get Mary Peters here, Secretary of Transportation, to our subcommittee hearing. And I said, Ms. Peters, is there a plan to create a NAFTA superhighway? And he says, oh, no, Congressman Goode, that plan doesn't exist. It's all a myth. And he says, then Mrs. Peters spent the next 45 minutes describing how our highway infrastructure was going to be reconfigured to connect down into Mexico and up to Canada. So he said, they don't want to call it a NAFTA superhighway, but that's what they're doing.
Yes.
You know, we have to decide what the meaning of the word is, and no, I didn't have sex with that woman.
Exactly. Well, the selective use of words and terminology is the hallmark of this particular age we're in now. That this is used all the time, the politically correct words, etc.
I can show you paragraphs in Thucydides where he talked about the same problem. And what Thucydides identifies it is when people want to lie in politics, they invent a language which covers the lie.
Right.
And that's what a lot of this political correct nonsense does. It doesn't want us to see clearly and state what is. It wants us to cover it over with a term that is loaded with an explanation that makes us to go to sleep, you know, security and prosperity.
Yes. And this is not just this sort of has international connections also. The Council on Foreign Relations, for example, is certainly behind this idea of creating a North American Union, correct?
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And David Rockefeller, you know, I say the Republicans got confused that the Republican Party was a conservative party. Ronald Reagan brought the conservatives and moral Christians into the Republican Party. But ever since the 1950s, the Republican Party has been dominated by the Rockefeller wing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, David Rockefeller, the millionaire, billionaire, multinational guys who don't care about the United States of America. They don't want borders. They just care. Their God is quarterly profits.
Yes.
And, you know, they want to have all this erased so the corporations can be in charge, and we're walking down that path, Republicans and Democrats alike. You know, ironically, we're going to put into effect Hitler's dream of a fascist state where the corporations rule and the government's just there to serve the will of the corporations.
I think that's well said. Yes, it's exactly right. Do you see anything that we can do as the public to stop these kind of plans from really coming to fruition before, as you say, they get most of it done before we vote on it? Is there something we can do?
Well, I think at a grassroots it's happening. I was in Oklahoma a few weeks ago and gave a speech, and this group, Oklahoma Safe, organized to oppose the extension of the Trans-Texas Corridor north into Oklahoma. Everybody said, oh, no, there's no plan to take to build a new continental 4-football-fields-wide highway. It's just the Trans-Texas Corridor. It's just a little Texas solution to congestion on the roads. Well, I was in Oklahoma, and Oklahoma, the investment bankers are already there, and Senator Randy Brogdon, a Republican, gave a speech and documented a bill they've already defeated, which would have slipped in the authorizing infrastructure in legislation introduced into the Texas legislature that did not say to extend the Trans-Texas Corridor north. It referred to certain Federal Register paragraphs that would have accomplished that goal. And Brogdon says they had to fight it, they had to defeat it and expose it. And so they're already fighting a battle. You know, the investment bankers, the Sintras, the foreign investment capitalists of the world are in there, and the politicians have already got dollar signs rolling in their eyes. And it takes a few brave politicians like Randy Brogdon to say the Trans-Texas Corridor is going to stop at the Oklahoma border. Well, that's going to be a fight. And, you know, it's going to have to be fought at the grassroots level. There's 14 states that have passed, and largely Phyllis Schlafly's Eagle Forum has organized at the grassroots. They've worked with the state legislatures. 14 states have passed resolution saying no NAFTA superhighway and get out of the North American Union. Now, this is below the radar of the mainstream media, but I can assure you it's alive and well on talk radio. It's being seen on the Internet. At the grassroots, people are waking up to the reality that they're losing their jobs, they're losing their homes. You know, the Bureau of Labor Statistics just reported since 2000, 94.4% of all Americans, even educated, college-educated Americans with skills, have lost real income. Only 3.4% of the population has gained real income, and those are the multinational corporate executives, their owners, and the lawyers and accountants who work for the multinational corporations. And it's clear that as this economic dysfunction of globalism, this lie of free trade, it was never classical free trade to say that the comparative advantage of a country like China would be that it could subsidize its currency, could use slaves or near slaves to produce the goods, it could import defective products, including lead paint on toys for children and poisonous food, and it would allow its corporations to destroy the environment. And then we allow our corporations to go over there into China and set up a subsidiary and get all those advantages. Well, the classical free traders would have told you that inevitably sets up an imbalanced trade. It's a lost situation. It's not fair trade. And a country that's going to be a rogue state like that needs to be dealt with through tariffs and other barriers which prevent them from exploiting their labor and importing defective products.
Well, Jerry, I feel this is a hot enough issue that perhaps it even could bring some kind of major revolution against governments, and I assume that the powers that be are preparing for that too.
Well, I report in the book, and I report, you know, Lake Great USA is about a power grab at the executive level. President Bush in May signed the National Security Presidential Directive 51 and Homeland Security Presidential Directive 20. He authorized himself to declare an emergency without having to go to Congress, as the National Emergency Act requires. It's not specifically referred to in these directives. And the president can then assume control of all national, state, federal, even territorial and tribal governments. That's an executive power grab that is exceptional. And, you know, the ancient Roman council ought to be getting out of their graves and applauding this. It's an ancient trick. Roman council, or the heads of the state, used to say, there's an emergency, we're dictators now, the Senate can go home, we'll protect the Senate. Of course, they never gave up their emergency powers, and they never stopped being dictators.
Well, these emergency powers, interesting enough, came after, of course, 9/11, when terrorism was the reason why Americans had to give up so many liberties in order to protect them from terrorism.
Well, and I interviewed Robert Pastor for the book. Robert Pastor is the professor at American University who's been preaching and writing about a North American community for 10 years. And Pastor, by the way, is not just an academic. When he was in the Carter administration at the National Security Council, he engineered the Panama Canal being given to Panama. Now he wants to give the United States to a North American community. Pastor said to me, he wrote first this article in Spanish, he gave an interview, and I read it in Spanish. I called up Pastor and said, did you really say this? I said, yes, I did. He said in the interview that the next 9/11 might be just what's needed to further the process of North American integration. I said, okay, fine. I mean, you know, there it is. Are we, in effect, going to, you know, some way or other, we're going to be told that the currency is devalued to such a low point. We've, And we're not competitive anymore. We have to combine into a North American market and protect the perimeter around North America. That'll make us more secure. I mean, all the arguments are in place.
Yes, and it's all over on the negative side. It's a negative reason why we should do something that's assumed to be positive, which, of course, is taking away what you already have.
Well, and, you know, the late, great USA, I put 30 pages of footnotes in the book. And the footnotes, I didn't put them in to bore people. Every one of those footnotes virtually is a website. And you can, I put the website address in there so you can go see the documents with your own eyes. It's the same way I write in WorldNet Daily. My articles have links. When you click on those links, you go see the documents that I'm talking about. Okay, now, it's kind of like the country western song. You know, the woman finds her husband in bed with another woman. Of course, the husband lies and says, this isn't what you think it is. So the woman's got a choice. She can believe her husband or her own lying eyes.
That's right.
And so now we're being told by George Bush, this isn't what you think it is. It's a conspiracy to think that this is going to integrate us to a North American Union. And I'm saying, fine, who are you going to believe, the lying husband or what you see with your own eyes?
Yes, it's the emperor has no clothes theme again.
And I'm confident. See, I mean, just to kind of give you one more before I know we have to wrap up, this whole case, it's just, not only is the Vincente Fox broken this week with his interview on Larry King, in which he admits that there was a regional plan that he and Bush had to extend these trade agreements to the point where they'd end up in a regional currency. Now, it's fully admitted. I don't know how they're going to get that cat back in the bag. There's also this case of Jose Medellin, or Medellin, who is breaking this week. This is a Mexican illegal immigrant, gang member, criminal, 18 years old in 1993. He and seven other gang members. The brutal crime, there were two teenage girls in Houston. They were coming home late from a pool party. They had to be home by a midnight curfew, and they took a back route. And these illegal alien gang member criminals accosted them. They brutally attacked them. They raped them, sodomized them, terrorized them for over an hour. They beat them so badly, one of the girls had teeth kicked out from her head. They took their belts, the girls' shoelaces. They strangled them to death with, you know, one criminal on each end of the belt, squeezing it and tightening it across the girl's throat till she died. And then they stole one of the girls' Mickey Mouse watches so they could give it to Medellin's girlfriend. Well, one of these criminals has already been executed. It happened in 1993. But Medellin got the bright idea that he hadn't been permitted to call the Mexican consul. So now he's got an appeal before the Supreme Court. And George Bush just yesterday sent over the Solicitor General of the United States to argue with and side by side with this Mexican rapist, criminal, sodomist's lawyer that the International Court of Justice in The Hague was right and that we should demand, that according to Mexican law and according to international law, that all these Mexican criminals should first be able to contact the Mexican consul. So we're going to be, if the Supreme Court goes along with this, we'll be setting international law as supreme over U.S. law. Supreme Court's already once rejected this claim. We'll be accepting that President Bush can dictate to the state courts what they must do. That violates separation of powers. State courts should correctly tell President Bush, go home, we don't care what you say, you're not in charge in the courts, you have no authority here. And if the Mexican national criminals want to be under the control of the Mexican consul, let them go back to Mexico. That's where Mexican law is.
Yes.
Instead, what we're doing, this case demonstrates the extent to which the president's now willing to go to protect even Mexican national, illegal immigrant, murderer, rapist, sodomist, criminal, killers, the teenage girls, which is going to be completely abhorrent to the American people. You know, President Bush is now, our Border Patrol agents like Ramos and Campion are in prison for 11 and 12 years for shooting after a fleeing Mexican drug smuggler. Gilmer Hernandez, another Border Patrol law enforcement in Rock Springs, Texas, in prison for shooting after a van of illegal aliens with coyotes that were going to run over him, speeding away when he tried to stop them for a traffic violation. Texas Rangers said Gilmer Hernandez did nothing wrong. Texas Rangers investigated it. They said he was protecting his life and life and lives of others who might have been hit by that speeding van. The commonality in these cases, in the, each instance, the and I published the 12 letters the Mexican Council wrote demanding that Gilmer Hernandez be prosecuted. Our Department of Justice, under Alberto Gonzalez, with Johnny Sutton as the prosecutor, prosecuted both Ramos and Campion and Gilmer Hernandez at the demand of the Mexican consulate. Well, now the Mexican consulate's demanding that these Mexican murderers be either get new trials, and some of them will have to be released because they didn't first get to drop a dime and call the Mexican consul before they were involved with our criminal justice system.
Unbelievable.
Well, so if anybody has any doubts that, you know, this integration in North America is happening at a great speed, and that it does involve a necessary compromise of our sovereignty before anybody votes on it, I think these cases, Vincente Fox's interview with Larry King and this Medellin case with President Bush defending the rights of Mexican criminals and saying, you know, what are we going to do next? Every Mexican who is stopped for a crime, the first thing that the police will have to do is call the Mexican consul. Well, we've got sanctuary law. We've got sanctuary laws. Police can't even ask if these people are Mexican or Mexican illegal. So I guess everybody now comes under the becomes a suspect for a criminal investigation. Since you can't ask if they're illegal aliens or Mexican, the first thing that will happen is every suspect, they'll have to call the Mexican consul. Just involve the Mexican consul in every criminal investigation in the United States.
Well, Dr. Jerome Corsi, I want to thank you so much for being on Authors Audio today. We could talk at length about many more aspects of your book. I have read your book, and I urge all my listeners to pick up a copy of The Late Great USA and inform themselves on what's really going on behind the scenes in the creation of a North American Union. We have a direct link to your book from our website at authorsaudio.com.
Jake, pleasure and honor to be with you. I'll be happy to be back anytime you ask. Thank you.